So, let me just take a minute and actually, let me say one thing first, and then give you the introduction I was going to give you. First of all, I want to remind people that over lunch today, for those who wish to attend, Lynn Kay, who is, I don't remember exactly her title, but the non-assistant rabbi, assistant rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue, and really a remarkable person and an amazing teacher, and one of the people who's really kind of, you know, pushing the envelope about women's leadership in the Orthodox world, will be coming to give a shiur on mystical readings of the Talmud and what that means. That'll be over lunch for those who want to attend, which is recommended. She's really a great person, so it's a good opportunity. So a couple sentences by way of introduction. Where we are in the sort of trajectory of this series of shiurim, you may remember that at the very first shiur I said that I wasn't sure yet whether this was going to be the heart of Torah, seven Jewish ideas to change your life, or the heart of Torah, three Jewish ideas expansively. And that's because I was sort of struggling with whether the main ideas I wanted to talk about made sense to kind of break up and do individually, or to sort of imagine them going under these big headings. So, for example, right, with Tzelem Elohim, we talked about dignity, belovedness, the sense of shlichut, right? So, in the end, we're going to do this around three main themes, but, you know, the numbering thing is kind of a game. It's actually not that significant. I'm more interested, obviously, in the concepts, the ideas, and our kind of attempts to internalize them. So similarly, what I want to try to do in these last two shiurim that we have in this series is I want to look at the idea of the halachta bidrachav, of walking in God's ways. Some of you have done versions of some of these texts with me, some of you have not, and again, we'll do a mix of sources presumably most of you have not seen and sources that presumably all of you have seen, and I hope we'll be able again to sort of read them with new questions and interests in mind. Depending on how far we get, next time what I think we might do, we'll either finish this packet or we will actually spend some time looking at one, the same way that we used Rav Dessler to get at some of the questions of gratitude and giving. Next time we might look at one Italian modern Jewish thinker, Shmuel David Luzzatto, better known as Shaddal, and his argument that compassion is the essence on which Torah is built. Something that he writes about all over the place. So, v'halachta bidrachav, walking in God's ways. The conceptual introduction that I want to just make is very brief, and it's basically this. My argument, and I'm not totally sure that I'm right, but I would like to think that I'm right about this, is that v'halachta bidrachav, walking in God's ways, is the sort of logical conclusion of both of the first two themes we looked at. Meaning, right, Tzelem Elohim, the fact that a human being is created in the image of God, is commonly taken to imply that he or she also has the capacity to act in ways that God acts. Right? So, to say this in the language of philosophy, imitatio Dei is a kind of corollary of imago Dei. Right? Walking in God's ways is a consequence of Tzelem Elohim. Footnote to that, that's about a matter of history that I think is interesting. Personally, I don't really know what to make of this. Anyone wants to sort of think about this with me, I'd be happy. I have not yet seen any rabbinic source that explicitly makes that point that seems so obvious to us. Meaning you find it in a lot of 20th century Jewish thinkers who will say some version of, oh, because the human being is created in the image of God, he or she is capable of acting in God's ways. There's no Ma'amar Chazal that says that. That I have seen. And I think I've seen most Ma'amrei Chazal by now, that if not all, that are about this notion of halachta bidrachav. Meaning, either it's so obvious that it doesn't need saying, or it's so obvious to us and that says more about us in a certain way than it says about them. So I say that just because if you have interest in history, it is really striking. Because by the time you finished reading Soloveitchik and Heschel and lots of other 20th century Jewish thinkers, totally obvious. And yet, Chazal don't make the conceptual link explicit. By the way, if those are interested in Kabbalah, one of the places I think where this is first made very explicit is in the first chapter, the beginning of Tomer Dvorah, right? The book of ethics written by Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, right? Great Sfat Kabbalist, who begins by saying, we're created, this is interesting going back to our shiur at the college, we're in the week of learning, B'Tzelem Elohim, meaning we have some physical resemblance to God. And then, what is the mitzvah? To really manifest that in the world through V'halachta Bidrachav. Okay, so I just put that out there. If anyone has any thoughts about why that might be, I'd be very happy to hear them at some point. Now, so that's one piece. The second piece is, as I tried to suggest when we learned the Rambam, Moreh Nevuchim, right, Perek Gimel, Chelek Nun Gimel, 353 in the guide, gratitude for a world and a life that we did not earn seems to me, according to the Rambam, to generate the inspiration to want to become the kind of being who, as it were, passes that forward. Right? What some later Jewish texts will call, 20th century Jewish texts will call chesed mitgalgel. Right? Because I have received chesed, I have the urge to then pour it forth. I want to, right, continue the love that I have received, continue the graciousness that I have received into the world. So, the argument that I'm going to suggest, and the coherence of the book hinges on this being true, so I hope it is that both of these first two points, Tzelem Elohim and gratitude, both kind of are lead to this conclusion that V'halachta Bidrachav is kind of, let's say for now, core to what it means to take Judaism as a spiritual path, as a religious way of life, seriously. Okay. Any questions or unclarity about what I just said? Jana, please. And I'm going to pass around packets now, but I'm going to ask you to not, you know, spend your time now just looking at the packet rather than being part of the conversation.
Go ahead, Jana. If you don't want to go down this road for time and topic's sake, that's fine. But in terms of why there doesn't seem to be this connection between Tzelem Elohim and Halachta Bidrachav in Chazal, and your first option was maybe it was so obvious to them they didn't mention it, but if it wasn't obvious to them, can you say why you think that might be? Like, why did they not draw that connection? Is it something that they would have balked at? Would they have totally not seen it at all? Would they just miss it?
Honestly, I don't know. I'll tell you a couple of totally, like, spontaneous thoughts, meaning I just thought of them right now as you asked me that question.
Great.
One is, if they think, and I really don't know if this is right, okay, but I'm going to put this out there. If we're willing to explore the possibility that maybe Chazal thought V'halachta Bidrachav was something that had some aspect that was uniquely part of God's covenant with Israel, then it didn't make sense to derive it from Tzelem Elohim, which was about humans per se.
Okay.
I'm not totally persuaded by that because I think there are, you know, the fact is there are psukim like Etai Elohim Italich Noach, which I don't see any evidence that Chazal explicitly tied that to V'halachta Bidrachav in the sense of chesed, but meaning I would have to do more work to argue that that's a plausible case, and that work might in fact be impossible because I'd end up necessarily arguing from silence. Right? Is that clear what I mean by that? Right? In other words, because I'm basically speculating on why something isn't there. That's the only thing I can think of, right? Is that they think V'halachta Bidrachav, at least as a category, is uniquely covenantal. And therefore it has to derive in some way from Sinai rather than from creation. But I don't know. That's a very particularistic reading of Chazal. There are certain scholars of rabbinics who would like that. Alon Goshen Gottstein, who I mentioned, is one of them. Other people, I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, yeah.
Okay. But what about something you mentioned? You did talk about Tzelem Elohim, or the people who try to read that as being, even, and you don't buy this reading, and most of us, I would hope, don't either, that Tzelem Elohim is actually really only about Jews, too. So if you follow that, then
maybe if what I just said, that speculation was right, it's one more argument
against
that view.
Right, okay.
Right.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Joshi.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm wondering if you could just say one more sentence about how gratitude, like, I think you unpacked the Intatio Dei, like, a lot, but...
Well, I intentionally left it a little bit vague. I think the idea was, in a way, go back to what we talked about Heschel's use of the word indebtedness, that when I receive a gift, if I've really received it, or if we use Heschel's language, if I've received not just the gift, but the love that's implicit in the gift, then almost by nature, what it does is open me towards the other. Right, there's a way in which, I mean, I don't know if people would like this formulation. I'm just sort of going to experiment with it for a second. If I receive without any impulse to then be a giver, there's a way in which I have not fully received the fullness of the gift. Right? Because something has not been planted in me. In other words, I think the idea is that to truly receive a gift is that there's, and it would be interesting to ask, you know, people who are more kind of inside of the language of like developmental psychology about this, right? Is this actually accurate in some way? But I think the intuition of a lot of religious texts is that in receiving something, it elicits an impulse towards reciprocity. And I don't even mean reciprocity in terms of repaying you. I mean, just a kind of like, oh, because I've been blessed, I want to, right?
Do something.
Yeah.
Not just like feel something.
Yeah, right, exactly. That there's this kind of impulse that may even be, I don't want to say instinctive, because that's people use that word. It's an impulse that is deeply, deeply rooted and may even be true about babies. I don't know. I mean, this is where some of this stuff, where actually like the conversation between theology, meditation, and psychology are all really interesting and fruitful, and there's more to say here. Vicky, just anything you want to say about that? Okay. All right. So let's look at these texts for a second. Now, so I wanted to start, by the way, I apologize, unlike all the other packets we will have this time, this series, I am not yet finished translating this packet. This is post-Israel, you know, whatever. Okay, so hopefully you'll bear with me. So first, a text that is well known, but that I want us to actually just sort of like think about together for a minute. So from Bavli Sota Yudalid, Darash Rabbi Simlai, so Rabbi Simlai taught Torah, Tchilatag Milut Chasadim, Vesofag Milut Chasadim. Tchilatag Milut Chasadim, Dichti Vayas Hashem Elohim Ladam Lishto Kotnot Or, Vayal Bishem. Vesofag Milut Chasadim, Dichti Vayikbor Oto Bagai. Right? So Rabbi Simlai basically says, right, Torah begins with an act of loving kindness and ends with an act of loving kindness. The act of loving kindness at the beginning is Malbish Arumim, right? God is the one who clothes Adam and Eve, and it ends with Kover Metim, God burying Moshe. And all I really wanted to just sort of point out here is, right, this is a great opportunity to avoid the pitfall of reading the rabbis in a tone-deaf way. Right, reading the rabbis in a tone-deaf way, what I like to call that is basically when we read Chazal, and it's like, oh, that's interesting. What's the next line? Especially it's Agadah, so let's just keep going. Let's cover ground, right? And actually, the statement here is actually kind of interesting, because what does it mean when I say to you, right, let's imagine that I'm describing Hannah to you, and I say, the beginning and the end of her is kindness. What I'm basically saying is, right, that like her whole gestalt is animated by kindness. I give you the example only because of the inherent absurdity of it. No, I'm kidding. Right? Right? If I say the beginning and the end of something is chesed, I'm not like making some dumb claim about how Torah begins and ends with something. I'm actually telling you something about what I think lies at the very heart of its project. I think that that's pshat. I want to say, like, I of course, you know, like anytime you're interpreting an Agadah, someone will likely raise their hand and say, well, how do you know that's pshat? I can't prove to you that's pshat. Except I want to suggest something else, a much less well-known text, which I'm guessing no one has seen, which I think really makes this point almost explicitly is if you look at the next text, not yet translated, Kohelet Rabbah, very similar. Amar Rabbi Brechia, Gemilut Chesed Batorah, Berosha, Uve Emtziita, Uve Sofa. And now he's going to give examples. What's the difference here? He's also saying, now if I said Hannah Kapnick, right? The beginning of Hannah, the middle of Hannah, and the end of Hannah is all kindness. Now does it sound like I'm making some claim about who she is even more explicitly? Right? In other words, it seems to be some kind of encompassingness to the claim about what Torah is. Which I want to put out there because, you know, those of you who have studied with me for a long time have heard me say this ad nauseum, and I will continue to say this, hopefully, as long as I'm able to say much of anything. And that is that some things are so fundamental and so important that it's easy to basically forget about them. And the argument here, I just sort of want to suggest, is that this should be an animating principle for what it means to interpret Torah, what it means to ask what Torah asks of us in our lives, right? To be animated by the principle that, right, one of its most ultimate aspirations, if not its most ultimate aspiration, is, right, the cultivation of chesed, or the description of God's chesed. Okay? Anybody have anything they want to sort of say or add about that or reflect on that? The reason why I did that was because I caught myself saying something that I think is not explicit. Namely, in other words, these texts that are quoted here are descriptions of God's chesed rather than explicitly mandates to our own. Right? The reason I said cultivation is that I think for Chazal, it seems pretty clear, right, that these manifestations of divine chesed, in fact, these very examples that are given, are regularly interpreted to mean these are paradigms to be emulated by humans. But I didn't want to be... I wanted to pull back from reading all the... Exactly. I didn't want to read all the other rabbinic texts into this one. Right? This one, at least, is about God's graciousness. Right? Is that clear? So that's description rather than cultivation of the human. Rachel, you look deep in... Okay. Anybody else? Avi?
Are we going to translate the rest of this God's Rabbah?
I wasn't going to, but we can.
I don't know. It's several of them were written. So if you could just the part that's about making Chava before the Emtah, just
let's not translate it now word for word. Let's just... Basically, the idea is that God creates Chava, brings her to Adam, and becomes their, like, the guy who helps organize their wedding. That's what Shushvin Shelahem means. Now, by the way, hold that example in mind for later, because... one of the things I'm going to try to suggest later is that, in general, texts about Valachta B'drachav are really interested in people in situations of profound vulnerability. And sometimes, but sometimes not, in that list is included kalot, brides. And I think it's interesting to think about why that is. Why is a bride on the same list as the naked, right, the hungry, the mourning? What's that all about? And there probably are interesting things to say about that. And anthropologists in particular, about transitions and boundaries, will probably have interesting things to say there. Right, that there's something about moving from one state into another that is inherently vulnerable. I don't know, but I think it's interesting. As I'm standing here, it occurs to me to say one other thing about that, the bride thing, which is interesting, which is I wonder whether Chazal are interested in the idea, which for some people is totally obvious and for some people is totally hard, of what it means to really be able to delight in someone else's happiness.
To what?
To really feel joy, happiness, because someone else is happy, which is basically what it means to be at a wedding. Right? Why else did you sit through all these nauseating speeches people give? I mean, I don't know that they did that in antiquity, but like, there's something about, right, really feeling joy in someone else's joy that might be very important to them. It's like a deeply self-transcendent act. Yeah, Liara, please.
I'm just mentioning that you get it, like, your transition creates vulnerability, but I sort of think as if, like, is that really the essence of what the is about? And maybe, you know,
the essence of? I can hear you. By the way, yeah, and I think part of the reason is because they imagine marriage as basically a woman moving from one man's home to another. It's totally gendered. Totally. I mean, I'm not sure what you said and how I interpreted it, other than that I chose to sort of elide all those important questions are different. Am I understanding you correctly? Yeah, I mean, I think, by the way, it's totally speculative. I don't know. This is another example of they don't, right? Chazal, there's no such discussion that says, why do we sometimes add kalot to this list? And there might be other reasons. I don't know. I mean, maybe getting married involves new levels of risk, because after all, getting married in that culture implies that one day you're going to bear children, which means a risk of your life. I don't know. I mean, we could speculate in all kinds of ways about this. That second one seems far-fetched to me, but I'm not sure how far-fetched. Okay. Now, just to sort of finish this sort of introductory piece, the Gemara, this is also a famous text, but I think it's worth really actually trying to figure out the inner, almost for lack of a better word, the emotional logic of this text. Hannah, would you be willing to read this? This is Sukkah Mem Tet Amud Bet, top of the next page.
Amar Eli Eliezer, or Elazar.
Elazar, yeah.
Mind Yichtiv, and usually Lamed Aleph. Pia Porcha V'Chochma, V'Torat Chesed Alashona.
End quote. Now, question about the Pasuk.
V'chi Yesh Torah Ashel Chesed, V'yesh Torah She'im Ashel Chesed?
Okay, this is a great kind of example of good semi-pshat exegesis, right? Mishlei says, Torah chesed al-shona, and the Rabbi Elazar asks a great question. What do you mean, Torah chesed al-shona? Is there some other kind of Torah? By the way, sometimes when I the risk of sounding melodramatic, sometimes when I read this question, my impulse is to start crying, right? Because, frankly, I've heard a lot of Torah that is not Torah, shel chesed, in my life. Yeah, right? Okay.
Ela, Torah lishma. Zohi Torah shel chesed. Shelo lishma, zohi Torah she'ena shel chesed.
So that's position one. Option one, right? Torah lishma. We're going to try to translate Torah lishma in a minute. And that's chesed. Torah shelo lishma is not Torah shel chesed. Okay? Ika da amre, go ahead.
Ika da amre. Torah
lilamda.
Lilamda.
Meaning to teach it.
Zohi Torah shel chesed.
Okay, so Torah that you're going to teach is a Torah of Chesed. Torah that you're not going to teach is not a Torah of Chesed. So, what's going on in these answers? What is the logic, would you say, that animates these two different positions about what constitutes Torah Shel Chesed? What is the... Why is... Excuse me, Torah Lishma, Torah Shel Chesed. Yeah, Becca. Okay, thank you. That's great. Yeah, Alana, you want to?
The same thing. I think it's about intrinsic value versus utilitarian value. And I think that it's almost like a training wheels of seeing intrinsic value. Because it's in the context of this shiur, I was saying,
Great. Okay. Good.
I think both of those things are true. I think prior to that, it's just the idea that Torah, sort of on its own, there's maybe some kind of like structure that only when infused with certain motivation or certain intention takes on attributes of chesed or doesn't take on attributes of chesed. It's like the internal stance towards it.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Alan?
I think that when they answer the question that... the nature of the question changes. Like, on first look, it's like it's almost assuming that the lesson of the Torah you're learning is about chesed. But it seems like the answers they're giving are answers to what type of learning is itself an act of chesed.
That's interesting.
So the first answer, like, it would be an act of chesed because it's for free. You know, it's like being given generously, like just lishma, you know, with not taking anything out of it. And the second answer would be, it's the same thing. It's being learned so that it can be given away.
Interesting. So that actually, in an interesting way, grafts onto what Rebecca said, right, about the receiving and the giving being in this kind of, I don't know exactly what word to use, but some kind of spiral with each other. Hannah, yeah.
I don't know if this is like what Alan was touching on too, but like, it's funny that they read it as like the chesed modifying the Torah, like, and my initial reaction was the Torah modifying the chesed. So it's, can you have chesed without Torah? Not what kind of Torah doesn't have chesed.
You understood the pasuk that way?
Well, like, I thought that was where they might have been going with their questions.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, Hannah, these comments are all really interesting. I'm glad they're recorded. Yeah, I can plagiarize you. Yeah,
I heard it a little bit more as like about being in relation with God as the lishma, or about it like bringing it into the main azam chaveiro realm.
Great. Okay, so it's interesting because one of the things that I think, I don't know if anyone said this consciously, but I think it came up sort of implicitly in a few places, is, are the two positions here a disagreement, or are they versions of things that are overlapping? Right? What's the relationship between Torah lishma and Torah lelamda? On the one hand, right? Torah lishma, I'm going to say something about what the word lishma means in a second, and Torah to teach on the one hand, and shelo lishma and shelo lelamda on the other. Right? Now, Torah lishma, some of you may know this, but you know, in the history of Jewish thought, there's a lot of debate about exactly l'shem ma, right? Torah l'shma, right, is, right, just to sort of clarify the Hebrew for a second, means Torah for her or its sake. And the question is, what's the it? And usually, people will say something like, especially, right, Torah for the purpose of Torah. But that only begs the question, what do you mean by that? Are you talking about learning without being focused on doing? Are you talking about learning for the purposes that Torah has in mind, as opposed to for your own aggrandizement? What are you talking about? Gordon Tucker has this very interesting thing where he translates Torah lishma. I think it's a very intriguing idea, right? It may seem obvious to some of you, but he translates Torah lishma as Torah for its proper purpose. Not Torah for its own sake, but Torah for its proper purpose, which I think is actually very... It frames the question quite powerfully. By the way, Hasidim and Mitnagdim, one of their basic fights was about this, right? Hasidim often talked about learning Torah for the sake of achieving Dveikut, some kind of almost ecstatic connection to God. And Mitnagdim very often said, really try to get shot in a Tosfot while trying to have ecstatic devotion. Torah Lishma means Torah to understand what the Torah says. Right, one is a very sober vision of what it means to learn, and the other is obviously as a very ecstatic vision of what it means to learn. But just to sort of tie together what some people said, and this is, you know, just an attempt to, may just be another version, or maybe an attempt to synthesize, I'm not sure yet, is that it really does seem here, right, that there is some intrinsic connection between Torah Lishma and Torah of Chesed, meaning some claim is being made about the proper purpose of Torah somehow being connected to Chesed. I think that's right. I honestly never thought about that until I gave a version of this shiur in Israel last week, where I think the l'shema of the Torah can be understood as, right, the realization of chesed in the world. That's what it means. And in a similar vein, what's the difference between Torah l'lamda, Torah to teach, and Torah shelo l'lamda, Torah not to teach? Torah shelo l'lamda very easily becomes the acquisition of information. Right? What's my goal? I want to know a lot. Well, that's great. But what does that do as a form of service of God? Torah l'lamda, right, is basically I'm learning, I'm receiving so that I can. That's exactly what Rebecca said, actually, now that I think about it. It's the sort of the reception that then turns into an overflow. I learn in such a way that I have to share. And by the way, as a footnote here, and maybe this is my own midrash on this, I'm not sure this should be limited to standing in a classroom and teaching. I think the notion of Torah l'lamda might include things like learning Torah in such a way that the way I act in the world teaches something. Right? I'm not sure it has to mean like, oh, the only people who do Torah l'lamda, that would basically mean the only people who are Torah shel chesed are professional Torah teachers, or people who give shir. I think there's something much more profound going on than that. What it means to be a teacher of Torah can be much more subtle. Go ahead.
This is like a half-formed thought, but I like can't get over the fact that the verse that they're picking is about a woman.
Yeah.
And right. That the Torah is feminine, and l'lamda and l'shma can be for her sake and to teach her, and that in some way this woman is also acting as a teacher, and that this pasuk is the pasuk that the rabbis chose, even though most of them believe that women don't have an obligation to study or to teach Torah, that like this text is kind of amazing. I don't know what else to
write
say about that.
No, that's amazing. You should play with that. At very least, there's an amazing drasha and or piece of theology in there.
Yeah.
How conscious is that on their part? No way to know, but I'm not sure it should matter in this context.
Right, I mean, the extension could be like, maybe if I wanted to like say it totally gendered, which I'm kind of opposed to doing things like that, but to say like that chesed is like a feminine side of it, or like, I'm sure there's something about that.
Yeah, I mean, Kabbalah is...
Yeah.
Well, Kabbalah is an inverse. Kabbalah consciously inverts it in a really interesting way, which is either deeply sexist or deeply interesting or potentially both, right? It actually makes the claim that Chesed is male and Din is female, which is precisely how we would not expect them to go.
Well, it goes with the active-passive stuff that Kabbalah does.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's all it goes with, but yeah, fair enough. Okay, great. I'll say more about this later on. Okay, now, the next part, I want to, this is really in some ways the heart of what I want to try to draw out, is the notion of the notion of chesed and personal integration, and we'll see what that means in a second. So, one sentence of background is that five times in Sefer Dvarim, the Torah commands us lalechet bidrachav, to walk in God's ways, and no times in Sefer Dvarim does it flesh out what that consists of. I suppose, as we'll see in a minute, that one might be able to speculate that v'halachta bidrachav is merely a kind of hakbalah, merely a kind of parallelism to the notion of keeping God's mitzvot in the pshat of Dvarim. I'm not so sure, but it is really interesting. It's this very basic term that is not given any content. So let's take an example for a second. Now, just reading one verse for a second, Dvarim Yud Yud Bet. This verse has become very important to me in trying to develop a theology of chesed. V'atai Yisrael ma Hashem Elohecha sho'el mi'imach. Ki'im li'ra'at Hashem Elohecha, la'lechet b'chol drachav, u'le'ahava oto, v'la'avod et Hashem Elohecha, b'chol vavcha, b'chol nafshecha. And now, Israel, right? What does God ask or demand of you? This, li'ra'at, to fear awe the Lord your God, la'lechet, to walk in God's ways, le'ahava, to love, v'la'avod, and to serve. By the way, have I talked in this group about why the same word in Hebrew applies for awe and fear? Have we ever talked about this? Because I think it's actually interesting to think about. If we didn't know Hebrew, I think we would find it very odd, as like Americans who learned English, to think that in another language, fear and awe are the same, like, Hebrew word, right? In other words, I can imagining those two terms very far apart.
Awe,
I would translate it
as
yirata romimut. Velo, nagid lamashal, yirata onesh. Okay? The fact that yirata onesh and yirata romimut, the fear of being punished, and awe in the face of God's grandeur is the same Hebrew word is interesting, right? And I'll just put out, because we don't have the time to really kind of focus on this, something that one of my teachers, Bernie Steinberg, once said, and I think it's actually deeply insightful. He said the reason why he thinks that the same word is that sort of the psychology of the Bible here is that awe is what happens to fear when it ceases to be about me. Meaning, imagine the difference between, oh God, you are so mighty and powerful, you could destroy me in an instant, versus, oh God, you are so mighty and powerful, sof pasuk. Right? End of story. Meaning, maybe put it in a different way, awe is fear that has self-transcended. Right? The fundamental question is no longer, God, what does your power say about my future? But rather, the statement is now about your power, or your greatness, or your love, or whatever. And this sort of there kind of conceptual closeness. Which actually, by the way, also makes sense when you think about how many Jewish spiritual texts talk about graduating from Yirata Onesh to Yirata Romimut. How basic that is. Right? The notion of graduating from fear of punishment to awe. In fact, there's a lot of interesting texts that speculate about whether fear of punishment is actually fear of God at all. Because you might just describe fear of punishment as raw self-interest. Right? Rabbi Louis Jacobs famously says at one point, you know, fear of punishment is not fear of God, but fear of what he might do. And that's actually not what the Bible means by fear of God. Yeah, Avi, please.
I just keep forgetting to ask you to maybe send, point me to where I can read about that, the transition in classical Jewish text. So.
Yeah, okay, sure. There's a couple of, yeah. You find it most dramatically played out in a variety of Hasidic sources about Yira, which I can point you to. Okay, so now, here's, for those of you who have heard versions of the Shiur, try not to answer this question, right? But let's just say something about the patterning of the verbs in this pasuk. There's something interesting here that I want to just sort of bring our attention to. We have, just to remind you, we have the mandates are liyirah, lalechet, laahava, laavod.
I see them as in some ways becoming more like demanding more to yourself, like to awe or to fear something, and be viewed as like an entirely external act that you might not necessarily mean, like you cower in fear without it, meaning to let that is like to actually walk. Begin demanding something of your heart and avodah, like in order to serve something, in order to serve a God that like will truly require some sort of belief.
Interesting.
I'm not sure exactly how the pattern works, but yeah. It seems like there's some sort of playing with like the external versus the internal like levels of belief.
Great. Okay, interesting. Anyone want to plan that? Jordan and Shana?
I see that, and then I would say I also almost see them as causal. So if you fear God, you will walk in his ways. If you walk in his ways, you'll learn to love God. And when you learn to love God, you will truly serve God.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so it's like a deepening of commitment as it goes. Yeah, right? Go ahead, Shana.
So I feel like a little bit different, but I think I see them as like pairs, and that it's like an emotional response and then like a physical action, and then like again an emotional feeling and then another physical way of doing something. So like in the fear and then the like act of walking in God's ways, and then the like loving God being the emotion, and then serving God like through each vote is like another action.
Great. Okay. So I want to think about what you guys said and whether or not it maps onto what Shana said. It sort of does. And yet, Shana's reading La'avod differently than you did, Rachel. Shana's focusing more on the action of La'avod, whereas you're talking in a way about a more sort of totalistic, right? My instinct here, although I'm not sure that it's the pshat of the pasuk, is to read, Shana, very close to what you did, which is that one of the things that's interesting about this pasuk is the patterning, the serugin, right, of emotion, action, which I think at least hints at part of how the Torah is going to understand, a core part of how the Torah is going to understand the meaning of walking in God's ways, which is that it is something about the integration of the inner self and the outer action. There's something about the whole person being drawn in. And in a way, just to sort of take us kind of in anticipation of where we're going, right, this is, you know, my argument anyway about how Chazal understand Chesed. See, here's the thing. Right? Although, as I said, Sefer Dvarim does not tell us what walking in God's ways means, right? An overwhelming thrust of rabbinic literature is that walking in God's ways means doing chesed in the world. And we'll talk about that more in a second. But what I actually sort of want to suggest is already hinted at here, and we'll see it played out in these rabbinic sources in a minute, is that the notion of the inner and the outer being totally integrated is the Torah's aspiration. That is, I act lovingly to someone out of a feeling of love towards them. Now, here's the sort of footnote comment, which, you know, is basically my favorite tirade, and I'll try to refrain from kind of doing it here, is that usually people, right, this is the consequence of a history of Christian caricatures of Judaism that also, in different ways, are internalized and accepted by a whole line of people, Spinoza, Mendelssohn, in 20th century Israeli context, Yeshayahu Leibovitch, all of whom basically make some version of, oh, what Judaism is interested in is laws. That's all it really is. Right? And that leads to the horrible kind of caricature that says, right, Christianity is interested in feelings, Judaism is interested in actions, right? Of course, right, the problem with that is that it's basically like a caricature of Christianity and a caricature of Judaism, right? I always like to say, other than that, it's extremely insightful comment, right? Meaning Christianity is not just about feelings. That's the way Jews tend to talk about Christians in pejorative ways, right? Oh, Christianity, that's just, you know, as long as you love, it doesn't matter what you actually do in the world. Interesting. Then why are so many of the aid workers in the third world deeply devout Christians? And Jews are just interested in actions. Really? Right? Except for, right, basic, like, or the Gemara famous is saying, Rachmana libabai, right? God desires the heart. So the way that that is true, right? Here's the one sentence on this, right? Is that if you asked Chazal, and I think this is true about any member of Chazal, if you asked Chazal, if I have a choice between feeling compassion for someone who's suffering, but doing nothing for them, right? Or not feeling anything, but doing something for them, they will always pick the latter, right? But that's like saying, right, between bad and worse, which is your favorite? right? And they say bad. And then we walk around and say, oh, Chazal are in favor of bad, right? Because they prefer bad to worse. Or let's put it, let's be more generous, incomplete to worse, right? But obviously their lechatchila, their aspiration is, I should care about someone and manifest that care in my action. Now, the way that I like to render that in English is, right, you all know, at least those of you who are raised in America, that the standard way of translating chesed in English is loving kindness, a word that for most American Jews has no meaning at all, other than conjuring up other words from the Machzor we don't understand or relate to, right? You know, may thou in thy loving kindness bestow upon, you know, and all kinds of other things that I don't understand, right? But I actually think that it becomes really interesting if you reinsert the space between loving and kindness, right? If you reinsert the space between loving and kindness, you actually have an emotion manifested as an action. And as Rachel Druck will be happy to tell you, right, that's, you know, the way I think it's most helpful in contemporary Jewish theological and spiritual conversation to define chesed is love manifested as kindness, right? An internal manifested as an external. That's the aspiration, right? Doesn't mean it's the only thing that is sort of passes a certain bar, but the aspiration is love manifested as kindness. And what I'm suggesting is that that's already kind of like, the first hint of that is in the patterning of this pasuk. Similarly with, by the way, Ben Adam LeMakom, although that's not what we're talking about primarily here, Ben Adam LeMakom, the same logic applies. Right? I can say to you, oh, I love God. And what do? About I love? Well, I feel warm all over. Right? Or I could say, I have no feelings towards God, but I try to serve God. And I think Chazal would prefer the latter, but they explicitly say it's really only because they hope the latter will elicit feeling. Right? Should we talk shalo lishma balishma? Right? Out of not doing it for its own sake, you'll come to do it for its own sake. By the way, an interesting discussion that would be to have sometime, maybe this is like a sikha or something, is that true? Do you believe that mitok shalo lishma balishma, or mitok shalo lishma comes a life of non-mindful inattention? It's a very interesting question, one that Jews are usually very afraid to ask. The firmer they are, the more nervous they are, lest someone walk away and say, oh, I don't need to do anything until I feel it. And I have sympathies with that fear, but I think it's so important to ask this question. Right? What would one need to do for shalo lishma to generate lishma? Because probably we don't think it's automatic. Maybe we do. Okay, there's a lot of hands up. Can we... let's hold questions for 5 minutes. I want to look at two rabbinic texts, and then there'll be more to talk about, more to refer to in your questions and comments, okay? So now, what I would like to do is look at, probably you could argue, two of the most famous sources in all of rabbinic literature, and I want to read them as a pair and see how they relate to this thesis that I've just put in front of you, okay? So now... look, okay, Sifrei Dvarim Parshat Ekev. Adi, you're willing to read the Hebrew? Lalechet b'chol drachav?
Lalechet b'chol drachav, elu men d'rkei nash, d'rkei rachot. Hashem elu
b'chol drachav, ve'omer. Okay, footnote here, this is a really interesting textual problem. If you open your Tanakh to Yoel, you'll see Vayakol Asher Yikra B'Shem Hashem Yimaleit. It is also very clear that Chazal read this pasuk to say Vayakol Asher Yikare B'Shem Hashem Yimaleit. The difference being, right, one who calls upon the name of the Lord, or mysteriously, one who is called by the name of the Lord. If we have time later, I'll share with you something interesting about how one modern Jewish thinker deals with that problem. It's a very interesting example of the text in front of us and the text that Chazal seem to have are vocalized totally differently. Okay? So here, for the purposes of this midrash to make sense, you would have to read Yikare. Vayakol Asher Yikare B'Shem Hashem. Okay? Likare. Again, right? Because you'll see in a minute why I'm saying this. We're going to translate in a minute. The Oseh Matnot China. Ahev.
Ahev afata.
Ahev. Kama. Afata.
Afata yeh tzadik.
Period or semicolon, whatever. Nikra makom chasid.
Shneimar ki chasid ani neum Hashem. Afata yeh chasid. Vekach neimar veaya kol asher yikarev b'shem Hashem.
Okay, you know what? Let's stop here. Let's just stop here for now. So basically, the midrash just listed, right? It, the four qualities of God that it thinks are what enables one to be called, as it were, by the name of the Lord, and that is Rachum, Chanun, Tzadik, and Chasid. Now, without saying anything further about this. Actually, I'm sorry. Saying one sentence about this. If you daven out of the Sim Shalom Sidur, you may notice that one of the innovations of the Sim Shalom Sidur is that it picked these two texts as part of what you learn in the morning, instead of other more ritual texts. And yet, in like a classic weird incomprehension, it omits what I think are in some ways the three words that are kind of the punchline of this text, which are Ve'oseh matnot chinam, and God grants free gifts, which I would speculate are actually what the Rambam has in mind in that text we saw about the creation of the world. Ve'oseh matnot chinam, meaning God is the one who bestows gifts that have no basis. They have, right? Chinam, they're totally grace. I don't know why that's not in the Sim Shalom version of this. It's just mysterious. Okay? Now, let's just read how Sota elaborates or changes this, and then we'll tie it together, and then we'll take as many comments or questions as people have. Jana, will you read in Hebrew or English? Doesn't matter which one.
Is it okay to read in English?
Yeah.
Okay. Rav Thomas, son of Rav Kanina, further said, "What means the text, 'You shall walk after the Lord your God'? Is it then possible for a human being to walk after the Shekhinah? Or has it not been said, 'For the Lord thy God is a devouring fire'? But the meaning is, to walk after the attributes of the Holy One, blessed be He. As He clothes the naked, for it is written, 'And the Lord God made for Adam and his wife coats of skin and clothed them, so do thou also clothe the naked.' The Holy One, blessed be He, visited the sick, for it is written, 'And the Lord appeared unto him by the oaks of Mamre, so do thou also visit the sick.' The Holy One, blessed be He, comforted mourners, for it is written, 'And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed Yitzchak his son, and so do thou also comfort mourners. The Holy One, blessed be He, buried the dead, for it is written, 'And He buried him in the valley, and so do thou also bury the dead.'"
Okay, so let me ask a very simple question. First of all, what's the relationship between the Gemara and the Midrash Halacha? These texts are very often cited together. In fact, if you open Sim Shalom, I think that they follow on each other. So what's the relationship between them? Jana, please.
Well, I think the first text is sort of more the wider midot, like ways of intentioning yourself. And then the second text is giving examples of what that actually looks like. And I think there are a lot of times, even in the Tanakh, where you can ask where exactly is God being righteous, where exactly is God being merciful, where exactly is God being all of these things, such that we actually have a model for the behavior. So
I don't understand how you got to the seifa from the ratio of what you said. I got the first part of what you said. But
okay, so
I think it's a very interesting question what you raised. But how? The first part, you said something totally clear. How did that lead you to the second part about not knowing?
Well, I think one might read the first text and say, okay, that's great. First of all, how do I do that? And second of all, where is God doing that?
I see. Okay. All right.
And
good.
You know,
okay. I got it. Okay. So fair enough. So just to sort of say this in a very straightforward way, I suggest, right, that part of the sort of valence, part of what happens from reading these texts as a pair, right, is that you again have this kind of focus on the inner and the outer, right? It's almost as if the Bavli reads the Sifrei and is nervous, right? Oh, mahu rachum, gam ani rachum. I walk down the street and I'm very sad that other people are suffering, but I have a train to catch. And so the Gemara comes along and says, wait a second. And by the way, notice the really interesting work that this Bavli text does. It actually says midot and then lists actions. Right? It's almost incoherent, right? It says, right, v'heach efshar lo l'adam likarei b'shmo shel makom. No, I'm sorry. I looked at the wrong one. I'm sorry. After it says, v'haloch far ne'amar ki Hashem elohecha ish ochla, ela l'haloch achar midotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what's an example? Four concrete actions. Right? Wait a second. I thought I was talking about attributes. And the list is actions. So again, if we read these together, we have the first we're interested in, maybe instead of emotions, a better way of saying what Sifrei is interested in is virtues. Right? It's interested in midot tovot. Not hargasha, it's not just a feeling, right? But it's a kind of, it's a state of virtue. What in medieval Hebrew is called deot, but in modern Hebrew, that's confusing to people because they think of deot as opinions. Right? When the Rambam has hilchot deot, that does not mean the laws of what to think. It means the laws of virtue, the laws of moral consciousness, the laws of moral self-cultivation. So the idea is, I think, again, this sort of concern with the inner and the outer. Now, I just want to make a couple of small observations about these texts, and then the floor will be totally open. One is, this may be a total overreading, but it has always struck me, and it's sort of really interesting, that if you look at the Gemara in Sota, the first example that it gives is Malbish Arumim, God clothes the naked in the present tense, and the next three shift to the past tense. God visited the sick, God comforted the mourners, God buried the dead. And I wonder whether it's too much of a midrash to wonder whether this text is subtly signaling for those who are reading closely that the stories of the Tanakh are paradigms of God's behavior and God's concerns, but now the acting out of those things is left to humans, right? Mahu biker cholim. Amazingly, it does not say mahu mevaker cholim. So I think that's interesting. I don't know, but I think it's interesting and it's striking. Now, one other thing I want to just sort of point out about this second text. And here I'm quoting something from Zev Harvey, professor of philosophy at the Hebrew University, who makes this very interesting observation. He says, what's the structure of these four actions here? Clothing the naked, visiting the sick, comforting the mourners, and burying the dead. He says this very interesting thing, which requires a tiny bit of unpacking, so bear with me before you protest. He says that he actually thinks the list, the list gets more and more intense in the vulnerability of the person you're benefiting. And he explains that this way, right? More or less. Someone who's naked, presumably someone's so poor they don't have clothes, on some level, if I clothe them, I've solved the problem. This is obviously going to be a little simple, and it's not going to deal with every exceptional case, right? Someone who is sick, and here I really want to caveat this, at least in theory, has the potential to be healed. I don't know, by the way, this is something that only occurred to me recently to be interested in. Shana, one day you could do research on this. Do the rabbis really have a conception of chronic illness? Like an illness that's not going away, but that's going to stay with you for the rest of your life? I don't know the answer to that. Honestly, I never even thought about it until recently. But at least in theory, some illnesses have a cure. Or at least, maybe we'll want to say, some intensive flare-ups of an illness have the capacity to get better. Interestingly, the progression of comforting the mourners, this is the one that's the hardest, because we might say comforting the mourners is easier, right? That illness is a deeper form of vulnerability than the mourners, but this text says the opposite. And the reason Harvey suggests is because, in contrast to what I just said, someone who's mourning has just endured something that is by its definition completely irreversible. Right? Their life has now changed forever. There is no going back. Right? This person who was fundamentally crucial to them, whom they loved, has disappeared. And then, of course, the culmination of that, which is, you know, I think somewhat jarring to read, or jolting in a way, is burying the dead, which is, in Chazal's imagination, the ultimate vulnerability. Even though you could imagine an argument where you'd say, well, someone who's dead is not vulnerable because they're not there in some way, right? But the notion of the body being in need of being taken care of, but having no capacity to care for itself, is the ultimate vulnerability. And in fact, right, as many of you know, right, in rabbinic literature, burying the dead becomes known as chesed shel emet, the ultimate chesed, which also has to do with the inability to accept, to expect anything in return. Right? Because how do I know I'm being kind as opposed to self-interested? In theory, burying the dead is the ultimate test of that. There's a lot more to say about a lot of these. The last sentence I'll say, and then people can say whatever they want about all of this, is that I think there's something very powerful here about that the list of examples that Chazal give of people to be kind to are people who are in vulnerable situations. That is to say, people who at least part of me wants to do anything but be present to. Meaning, look, we can say, and I think we should say, there's tremendous virtue in being kind to my friend who's feeling sad. Or you can now give me a list of 7,000 examples of moments of kindness and presence to another we could be capable of in our daily life and that we could work on deepening. But what's interesting is V'alachta Bidrachav here seems to be concerned with dafka people who very often are impulses to turn away. Think about our own reactions, many of us. Like, you see someone who is poor and hungry on the street. How often do you have the fantasy that you could actually not have seen that? Or, right, the feeling that I get walking into the Jewish home, especially when I haven't been there in a couple of weeks, right? This feeling when you walk in the door of, oh my God, anywhere else but here, right? Or, right, funerals, right? They're hard, right? They expose our own vulnerability. We could say a lot about that. And I think there's something very powerful here about this list, which is about actually being working on the capacity to be present in places that frighten us. And so much so that I want to say something that is so obvious that I'm sure most people have never thought about it. Okay, right? That's how obvious it is, right? If this was all easy, Chazal would not describe it as the culmination of the religious life. If I could walk up to you and say, okay, you want to really get somewhere in the spiritual life? Manifest God's love in the world by taking care of vulnerable people. And you were like, okay, great, see ya, I'm going. Right? It wouldn't be a great achievement. The fact that Chazal described this as like the highest level of, in some way, embodying God's values suggests that it actually takes work to be able to do this. That it's not simple. It's not a straightforward accomplishment. And almost every one of us, not every one of us, but almost every one of us, has some sense of that by being at the home. Which, by the way, one of the reasons why, cruelly, I make you all go there. Because it's actually about, in a certain way, learning to be present in the places that are frightening. That's actually the idea. And I think Chazal are basically saying, like, yeah, right? This is hard. You think it's hard to, like, be medakdik and lametet melachot on Shabbat? Right? Try sitting with someone whose physical being repulses you. I think that's very much what they're sort of interested in here. What it means to be present. Okay, a lot of people have things they want to say, including people who haven't spoken yet. So we'll start with Ross. You had your hand up. Is it still relevant?
Yeah, still.
Please.
I'm kind of curious when we're talking about Judaism is also this religion of love and not just action. Mm-hmm. And some of those proof texts we're looking at were like, God wants your heart. And I'm kind of curious what, like, biblical meaning and rabbinic meaning of, like, what it means to love your God when you're giving your heart. Is that feeling, or is that like, I'm thinking about you, God?
Great. So, I maybe should have said this earlier. I think that in biblical Hebrew, ahava, love, I want to say this as carefully as I can, is not only an emotion, but it is also an emotion. Ahava, I think, means something like loving and therefore being willing to serve. It is not, right, just like, oh, you know, God, I think of you, and all kinds of slow ballads from the 1960s start playing in the background, right? It's not primarily about, I mean, I'm being flippant, I mean, seriously, it's not exclusively about a feeling. But the truth is, this goes back to something we talked about maybe like four sessions ago. I think that's actually true about mature conceptions of love between people too. I mean, if I basically said, you know, I love someone, and all that is a feeling inside of me, I'm not sure you would actually regard that as love in your more, like, critical moments. Love would have to mean something like, I have a feeling, and maybe even part of that feeling or integrated with that feeling is a desire to do good to that person. I think love, Ahavat Hashem in the Bible, is something similar. It's an orientation that includes an emotion, but it's not just an emotion.
And one's heart, when someone is the heart, it's an object of mind.
Yeah, right. It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been done, I think, recently on like sort of biblical anthropology and conception of person. I mean, some of the images in the Bible are so, like the notion that one's conscience is in one's kidneys. Right? I mean, you realize people daven this, but they don't have the right, bochen klayot. Right, that literally means God examines your kidneys. You ever wondered like what that's about? I mean, it's actually somehow this notion that God is the cosmic nephrologist, right? No, it's actually about this notion that, right? So that's a way of saying, I'm not sure. I think that the heart is some combination of feeling and wisdom. Remember last week's parsha, the notion of chacham lev, what that actually means, what heart wisdom is, and how that relates to mind wisdom, all that is worth thinking about, and I don't have a good answer for you. That's stuff I still need to both research and think about much more deeply. But it's a very good question.
And is there a rabbinic transition from interpreting ahava to mean like feeling of love leading and also accompanying action? Or do the rabbis have a different theme of interpreting?
Without having really thought that through, I would say that their notion of ahava, at least on the face of it, is fairly continuous. I'm not sure the rabbis are all that interested in emotion towards God per se, right? They're interested in emotion towards God as tied into a broader orientation, which strikes me as close to biblical. We could do more research about that because I'm giving you a totally impressionistic answer, but that would be my instinct. Okay. Anybody who has not spoken yet, Rachel?
Yeah, I was just wondering what the limits on following God's ways are, because this is a pretty incomplete list. I mean, there are things like Ma Hakadosh Baruch Hu Ish Melchama.
Right.
You know.
Great.
Ma Hakadosh Baruch Hu Kelkana. That, you know.
Yeah, great. So this is, you know, this is another way where one could take this shiur / discussion is, I think, a really interesting question that's really worth like reflecting on in really fundamental ways, even though we can't answer it definitively because it's again about rabbinic silence. But what allows, or maybe even requires, Chazal to say, oh, walking in God's ways, that's God's love, God's kindness, and God's compassion. Why didn't they say, just as God sends a plague when he's bummed or irritated, so should you? Just as God fancies himself a genocide in Deuteronomy, so should you. I mean, you know, you can get really kind of outrageous about this if you want, right? And I think there's actually something very interesting there about how Chazal understand, let me say this actually very carefully, how Chazal understand how the Torah understands what is the essence of God and what is sort of secondary manifestations. Meaning, so two things, okay? First of all, meaning I think it's that they think, right, that God's love is much more fundamental to who God is than God's anger. this is an argument, Rachi, if you read Heschel's The Prophets, you see Heschel tries to do something similar, to say that God's anger is merely a manifestation of God's frustrated love. Whether that's apologetics or a good reading of Chumash, I'm not sure. Of Nevi'im, I'm not sure. It's interesting. The other thing is, and this also says more about Chazal maybe than it does about Mikra, right? Than about Scripture. But it's very interesting. I think Chazal, and I can show you places where they say this, although not in this context, are very nervous about human anger because they believe that God is always in control of God's anger, and humans are basically never in control when they're angry. And so to permit humans to act on anger is basically to ask them to be out of control, and the Torah would never do that. There's a passage in Bereshit Rabbah somewhere where somebody, I don't remember right now off the top of my head, who says the difference between divine anger and human anger is that God is the master of God's anger, but anger is the master of the human who is angry. So I think there's two things. There's a statement about God, and there's a statement about human psychology. But I also would want to speculate, right, that Chazal also believe in trusting their own moral intuitions about who God is. And I think that's a really important piece, and it stands in contrast to the way some Jewish discourse, especially in the modern world, operates. Right? Chazal trusts their intuitions. And if you want to sort of play this out, isn't that, after all, what the story of Avraham at Sodom is about? Not just about the Torah accepting human moral intuitions, but actually sanctioning them and seeking them out. Remember, right? Remember how that story plays out. God actively goes out seeking Avraham's moral intuitions. And I think Chazal, in a certain way, take that as muvan me'elav, right? As sort of for granted. And that's not obvious to all Jewish thinkers. You could imagine a Jewish thinker who would say, well, moral intuitions subject them all to the sheer authority of the law, right? The posture is surrender. It's interesting. I mean, if you want to sort of play this out in a midrashic frame, you would say it's interesting that the word Yisrael, right, definition of what it means to be Jewish is about struggling, right, and sort of having a voice of your own. I once heard someone say, in a way that he intended to be triumphalistic, but you can read it triumphalistically, you could also read it as sort of interesting. He said he thought it was an interesting lens on Judaism and Islam, that the fundamental word in Islam, right, is Islam, which is surrender. And the fundamental word in rabbinics, in a way, is Yisrael, which is struggle. And there are two modes of piety, right? Now, I think that's probably an oversimplification, both of Islam and rabbinics, but it's an interesting way of thinking about two frames of what it means to enter into a relationship with God. Abby.
It seems, though, that these four examples of loving kindness are, on their face, considered loving or good or kind, and there's nothing to the substance of whether they're done well. So you can comfort the sick very badly, actually.
Right.
You can comfort a mourner, either awkwardly or in such a way that you actually accentuate their,
right,
heighten their grief. So is there anything to that? Is that just too much of a modern, like, it matters how you do these things,
well,
not just that you do that?
Well, remember what we saw in the sources the last time we met about one who does chesed, but who's does not do it with sevar panim yafot, does not do it with a kind of kindness of face. It's as if it's totally worthless. I don't think that's a modern concern at all. I think they're very interested in that. The notion of, like, oh, here. Right? You know, oh, you're sick? Here. Right? You know, I'm not even going to look at you, but I'll just, you know, do something for you.
Or even saying, like, there's a reason that everything happens.
Yeah, so, good. So, you know, obviously we can't do this now. As I sort of tried to suggest to this group during brief conversation we had at the Jewish home a few weeks ago, I think there are rabbinic sources that are pretty careful about telling you, be careful what you say to other people. And maybe we would render that, or maybe they had that in mind too, be careful about imposing your theology on other people's pain. Right? Which is a very dangerous game to play. Oh, you're suffering? Well, the world has to be ordered for me to survive, therefore you must have done something wrong. That's called Job's friends. Right? So, you know, by the way, that's good biblical theology, right? God does not approve of Job's friends. What are Job's friends about? I'll say anything to make sure that the world makes sense. And if you've ever, you know, right? You know, like, God forbid, right? But when I have opportunities to sit Shiva, right? It's amazing the things that people allow themselves to say to mourners. It's amazing, right? Like, that, by the way, it took me years to realize that, you know, that particular halakha about not saying anything and a Beit Avelim until someone has, something is said to you, is actually Chazal's way of saying, look, we know you're going to say something stupid. Because that's what people do. Because they're scared, and it's not obvious what to say, and it's horrible, right? So they basically say, why don't you wait to see what the person wants from you? As opposed to saying things like, oh, you know, your father would want you to do X. I might be walking to a gym and do something like that, right? All the time. And I think Chazal were very nervous about that. Or, right, I have no rabbinic text that says this, but the thing that I think makes people most crazy, and I've watched people do this, and I've had people come to me as a rabbi and tell me about this, and I've had people do it to me. I know exactly how you feel. Really? You also want to throttle yourself right now? Right? Right? No, I mean, it's interesting, right? I know exactly how you feel. Really? Right. Okay. Anyway, I think that's actually very important to sort of figure out like what it means to be present. And that's why I said it that way. And I would even say, Abby, based on your English, I would even, you know, interpret your English. When you say comforting the mourners wrongly, I don't think that's comforting the mourners. I think that's something else. It's soothing yourself at their expense, or something like that. Okay, other Rachie, please. Oh, and then Ellie.
Going back to the way that you responded to Rachie's question, you kind of answered this question a little bit for me, but I think the Sota text that the little Mishnah that Rachie quotes is inserted there about like Eshel Kalah is very, very interesting. And like the fact that this is the passage that has this list of actions as opposed to the other one in which that's not mentioned, I think is actually very much like responding to the tension that we're discussing.
That's beautiful, yeah.
We're going to discuss God as having all of these different attributes, some of which are bad. What we need to do in order to kind of like to prioritize the good is actually discuss specifics and talk about action, something that's actually like objective as opposed to feelings that are dangerous and could subjectively be understood in very different ways that could lead to something that is not like this idea of walking God's ways in the way they want to understand it now.
Interesting. So maybe it's worth, in response to Rachel, your comment and Rachel's question, to just say something like almost as a footnote that I think is interesting for us as we think about what relationship to the theology of Torah we have, right? In the world of scholarship known as biblical theology, which tends to be dominated by Christians, but not exclusively so, there's a tremendous amount of conversation in the last, let's say, 15, 20 years about how to make sense of divine anger in the Bible. And I think one of the things you find, it doesn't map exactly, but it you do find that, and it's interesting to think about, is those scholars for whom it's okay to say some version of, look, biblical theology is this, but our theology has some space between that and our own theology, those people will often say, oh, you know, the Bible has passages where God is explosively angry, seemingly out of control, in contrast to what Bereshit Rabbah says, right? Whereas those biblical scholars who, for usually religious, normative reasons, think, no, biblical theology is my theology, will often be pushed to say, no, actually, if you read the Tanakh well, you'll discover that anger is not fundamental to who God is. Now, I don't think you should ever be reductionist in this way. Oh, you're only saying that because you're from, and you're, right? But it is interesting, right? So Heschel, right, for whom, on some level, he thinks biblical theology and his theology are overlapping categories, right? He is, in other words, an interpreter of the Bible. Of course, anger is not the essence of who God is. Anger is frustrated versions of what's more fundamental, divine love. Whereas, you know, this one very prominent, probably the most prominent Christian biblical theologian of the 20th century in some way, or the last 50 years, Walter Brueggemann, who's not interested in saying, oh, biblical theology and my theology overlap completely, will say, oh, the Bible has many passages where God is simply out of control, right, there is a kind of almost, you know, consumptive rage, and that's biblical theology. And my theology doesn't have to overlap with that 100%. Now, so it a lot depends on where we're standing. In fact, I have a feeling, I don't know, and it would be interesting, some people in this room, were you sitting in a Beit Midrash learning Torah versus were you sitting in an Old Testament seminar at Yale, might actually interpret certain biblical passages differently, and it doesn't make you a hypocrite. It depends what project you're engaged in at that moment. And that's okay. I just think it's interesting to be mindful of that. Okay, I mean, that obviously could be a whole shiur. By the way, if anyone wants references about this, I'm also happy to provide some of those. Jana, and then I think we'll go forward. Unless there's someone who has not yet spoken who had their hand up. Oh, Ellie, I'm sorry, Jana. You know what? I forgot, Ellie. Forgive me.
Two questions in different realms. One on the surface. When you're saying like what the Pshat is and Drash, it seems to me that these four, the progression is just through Chumash. Like, it's just Breishit three after another and then Varim. Like when you say, you know, Rosha, Mitzvah, and Sofah. I think it might be a drash to try to find a more deeper progression than that.
Yeah, I mean, Harvey, you know, Harvey basically says the pshat is, it's a progression chronologically through Torah. But I want to suggest, Zev Harvey, want to suggest that there is more going on. You're going to sort of buy that or not. I mostly buy it. I think it's a very plausible reading of rabbinics. But this is, I don't think all that much really changes. It's actually a kind of a literary question in a way about the structure of this sugya, of this passage. But, okay, yeah.
The other is, when you're speaking about Yirat HaOnesh and fear and the difference and taking the I out of it to go into a sense of awe, how does that interplay with, what's the relationship between fear and the self? Like, can you have fear that God is going to do something to other people? Is that a sense of sympathy, or is that feeling? I'm trying to understand when you're taking the self in these two ways, how that relates.
To fear for other people?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'd have to think about that a little more. I think that Chazal would likely say that fearing for other people in certain ways is a higher place than fearing exclusively for oneself. But that's still not Yirat at its highest level. Right? In other words, there might be some middle ground there. In other words, better to... You know what's an interesting example of this, by the way? There's an amazing passage in Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay called Odido Fake, which is just like that. It's just this amazing throwaway. I mean, his throwaways are sometimes just incredible. He says, what is the lesson that God wants to teach Eov at the end of Sefer Eov? Right? Eov rants and raves and rants and raves about his own pain, and God basically is quiet. And then Eov prays for his friends, and God's right there and starts talking to him. Because God wants Eov to learn, when you're really worked up about someone else's pain, then you've really gotten somewhere interesting. Now, I understand that has the potential to ask for a kind of self-abnegation that is problematic. I don't think that's actually how he means it, but I think his point is, look, why do we do that, right? I mean, it's so, the notion of the Amida, right? Praying for something I really need and praying for it in the plural, but I need it. I don't want to think about other people who are sick right now. And the sort of the pushing to sort of include others in your, right, in your sense of concern is like very fundamental to what they're up to. I don't know that that's Yirat HaRomimut. It's a kind of more sophisticated version. You might even not call it Yirat all. You might call it Chemla. I don't know. I mean, it's a very interesting question. I'm going to think about it more. Let's just talk about it more after I've had time to process the question more. Jana, last question, and then we're going to push forward.
It wasn't a question, but if you want only questions, then you can move on. But
let's push forward a little bit.
That's fine.
Okay, yeah. Great. Okay, so I wanted to just bring this next text to your attention because it's sort of like famous, and although less famous than the others, there's an interesting debate here. Ve'anvehu, right? You all know this pasuk, Ze'eli va'anvehu. Rabbi Yishmael Omer, v'chi efshar levasar v'adam lahanvot lekono. Now, v'anvehu, its surface meaning is to glorify. I will glorify. This is my God. Ze eliba anvehu, Elohei aviv aro mimenu. This is my God to glorify, my Father's God to exalt and raise up high. Right? And yet, the word, the shoresh nun vav hey, can also mean a dwelling place, which is actually important. But here, it's taken, so the first position is, ela anavelo b'mitzvot, eselafanav lulavna'e, sukana'a, tzitzitna'a, tzitna'e, tzitna'a, na'a, tfilana'a. That is, in other words, zeili va'anveyu, this is my God to glorify. The first position is hidur mitzvah. What does it mean to glorify God? I will do things sort of in a way that really glorifies and makes more beautiful than what the law minimally requires. Okay, great. For our purposes, this is not what we want to focus on, although it's interesting to think about the relationship between the two comments. Abba Shaul Omer, Abba Shaul says, what does anvelo, excuse me, anavehu mean? Adamelo, or edamelo. I will become like him. Mahura chum v'chanun, afatara chum v'chanun. What does it mean to glorify God? To embody God's attributes. Now, what is this sort of interesting here? This is where like philology does interesting things for us. Rashi commenting on this is like one of the most famous Rashis in the Gemara. Rashi is interested in the question, how did anvehu lead to adamelo? Right? How did you get from, I will make myself similar, from the word nun ve, nun vav he? So Rashi does this famous thing, heve domelo, vilashon anvehu ani vehu. Rashi does his own little midrash on what does anvehu mean? An is me, vehu is vehu, me and him, we will be similar. Ese atzmi kemoto lidabek bidracha. This is, the reason why I actually love this Rashi, even though I'll say in a minute why it's not pshat, is this notion of real kind of covenantal partnership between me and God, right? What does it mean in a way to glorify God, to transform oneself into a being who manifests God's qualities in the world? That's what it means. What it means to glorify God. Not about, you know, how respectfully I talk about God in some abstract world. It's actually who I am in some fundamental way as a person. There is recent scholars of Aramaic have suggested that the Shoresh, Nun, Vav, He, in Aramaic, one of its meanings is to be similar to. And that's what Abba Shaul was simply interpreting one possibility of the pshat of what Anvehu is. By the time of Rashi, that seems to be lost. And so Rashi needs to make a midrash, Anvehu. How do I get Adamelo? I will be similar to him. Anivehu. Right? So that's a kind of Rashi's midrash here. Now, I lost what I was going to say. Okay. Anybody want to sort of say anything about this? Yeah, please.
Somebody can think of like a childhood role model or hero, like in the way that,
yeah,
you know, oh, that baseball player, I want to be just like him. I want to grow up and practice all I can and do what he does. And that is both in a way of me making myself similar to him and a way of kind of putting him up on a pedestal.
Yeah, great. Right.
Childhood image.
Yeah. But that childhood image reflects something basic about maybe what it means to admire someone, alachat kama v'chama off the scale, right, to admire God, if that makes, that image is a little weak, but yeah, great. So I want to show you something for a minute that is to me very important, and I'm sort of trying to write about this now, and you'll We'll see in a second if you find this persuasive or not. Now, as you know... Oh, you know what? Here's a one-minute footnote that's interesting. So, Stephen Geller, sort of very interesting literary reader of the Bible, suggests that in Sefer Tehillim, a verse that is extremely important to the Rambam, Lecha Dumiya Tehillah, which is usually taken to mean to you silence is praise. The Rambam understands that because once you realize how little you can say about God, you should better be quiet. Lecha Dumiya Tehillah. Geller actually thinks that the original pshat of that verse in Tehillim is Lecha Dumiya Tehillah, to you becoming like you is praise. Dumiya is in Dimayon and not Dumiya is in Sheket. To you being like you is praise. The most authentic praise of you that I can offer is to embody your attributes. Okay, that's an interesting footnote.
Who is that?
Stephen Geller. I don't know that that's been published, so I think just as he says. Okay, now, so this thing that I wanted to share with you is, you know, right, that many of the mitzvot in the Torah, and especially many ethical mitzvot in the Torah, but not only, right, are rooted in this repeated refrain in Chumash of Kigeri Mihitem Be'eretz Mitzrayim, right, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Now, I want to just look at two psukim for a second. These are not explicitly tied, anywhere in rabbinic literature to V'halachta B'drachav, and it wouldn't make sense if they were. But I want to go somewhere that I think is interesting here. I want to spend a few minutes looking at two of the famous psukim about the ethical consequences of having been strangers in the land of Egypt. Okay, so if you look at the top of the next page, first, Shmot Chav Gimel, V'ger lo tilchatz, V'atem yedatem et nefesh hager, ki gerim hiitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. Right? You shall not oppress the stranger, for you know the feelings of a stranger, having yourself been strangers in the land of Egypt. And then, V'yikra, V'chi yagurit hager ba'artzichem lo tonuoto, you shall not wrong the stranger, ka'ezrach mikem yiyeh, here, of course, in Vayikra, right, is this dramatic intensification. If Shemot was basically a mitzvah lo taseh, right, you shall not oppress the stranger because you were a stranger in the land of Egypt. Vayikra is a mitzvah aseh, right? You should love the stranger as yourself. Now, it would be interesting, right, to really contemplate what I think is often missed, which is, the Torah comes along, Vayikra, I think it's 1918, right, comes along and says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, and I say, great, love my neighbor as myself. All the people who also have apartments in the 95th Street and Broadway building that I live in, they're all my neighbors and I love them, right? Now the people who live under the building because they have nowhere to sleep, I don't know if they're really my neighbor. I mean, my neighbors, like people I feel comfortable with, right? As my neighbors. Or as I like to say, only the people in my tax bracket. Right? Those are my neighbors. And the Torah basically comes along and says, right, wait a second. Can I just clarify for a second what the neighbor includes? It includes the stranger. What is a stranger, by the way? You think I mentioned homeless people randomly, but what is a stranger in biblical Hebrew? Someone who has no land of his own. Right? V'ahavta, right, lo kamocha. You have to love those who are economically and politically vulnerable. Not just your friends who are emotionally vulnerable because they just had a bad breakup. I don't mean to put that down. But, right, there's something much more radical at play here. Or, if we want to use a Christian context, right, in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is asked, tell me, Master, who is my neighbor? Right, a good question in understanding Vayikra. And here, I think Vayikra itself dramatically pushes the envelope, right? And basically says, the other in society is your neighbor. Now, I want to say a couple of other things about this and then get to the point of why I put this here, okay? The other thing I want to point out that I think is very, very powerful and very easy to miss is the phrase, ka'ezrach mikem yiyeh. Ka'ezrach mikem yiyeh suggests political protection and not just your feelings of compassion. Right? What is an ezrach, even in modern Hebrew? That's a political category. It's someone who has citizenship. So when the Torah says, Ka ezrach mikem yiyeh, it's not just saying, listen, guys, you who have all the rights and all the power, you should have compassion for those who don't. The Torah is also saying that. But it's also saying, you should protect them legally. Right? This is really fundamental. To use the language of one contemporary writer, right? The vulnerable should not be dependent on your moral imaginings, right? Oh, I happen to see you as human, therefore I'm going to feed you. But you, I don't happen to see as human, so good luck to you. And this is like this radically interesting thing. Ka ezrach mikem ve'ahavta lo kamocha. It's both emotional, relational, and political. Which is exactly, and in some ideal way, what you want a society to do. Now, why did I bring this here? Because it occurred to me a few years ago, something really kind of amazing, that the Torah does something incredibly challenging and powerful, right? I'll say this in two brief stages. One is, there's nothing logically obvious about this reasoning. I could imagine someone saying, look, I was a stranger in the land of Egypt, and no one did a damn thing for me. Therefore, you know what I owe the world? Nothing. Don't bother me. And the Torah basically comes along and says, look, there's an option. Right? Your suffering and your feeling of abandonment can lead you to constrict your heart or to expand your heart. And by the way, as a footnote, this is now me shy talking. I think for most people, most genuine traumas probably do both at the same time, which is what makes life complicated. But the Torah here comes along and says, yeah, maybe that's a psychological option, but the ethics of the Torah is, you were a vulnerable stranger, therefore you can never turn your back on vulnerable strangers. Okay, so that's part one. Second thing I want to sort of just point out, okay? What is the ethos of the Halakhta B'drachav? God bestowed kindness upon you, therefore bestow kindness upon others. What is the ethos of loving the stranger? You were vulnerable and no one bestowed kindness upon you, therefore bestow kindness upon others. Meaning, when taken together, the mandate of the Halakhta B'drachav on the one hand and the mandate of Ahavat HaGer on the other basically say, you know, either turn the bounty you've been given into love, and turn your suffering into love also. Right? Ideally, in this life, we will learn love from feelings of having been loved. But there's also the possibility, as painful as it is, as undesirable as it is, to learn love precisely from the experience of not having been taken care of. It might be a lot harder. In fact, I think it is a lot harder. And I think there's something just sort of very interesting because, now let me say it one other way. The possibility exists to flip each of these. Here's my little thesis based on pastoral care, right? There's two reasons you can feel a sense of entitlement and not owing anybody anything. Right. Reason number one is, look, very few people would say it this way, but I've always had everything I ever needed. Everything has always been, whatever. Magieli. Right? This is what we call, in colloquial terms, being spoiled in horrible ways. Right? And the other form of time is, look, if you knew how I suffered, you would not ask me for anything. Leave me alone. And I think the Torah is here doing something very interesting, which is it's pushing back against both of those impulses. And essentially saying, right, you do know what it's like. And I, the Torah, as it were, am aware that this is not sort of intuitively obvious. This is why it's a mitzvah. I'm trying to teach you something, which is, right, turn your experience of being loved and your experiences of not being loved and ultimately aspire to turn them all into a deeper capacity for love. And with that, I want to suggest one sort of footnote. This is probably not pshat, but that doesn't bother me in this context at all. That va'atem yedatem et nefesh hager, you know the feelings of a stranger, should not be interpreted primarily as an indicative, but rather as an imperative, meaning it's not a description of your condition, you know what it feels like to be a stranger, but rather you should know your own experience of estrangement, because that is the only path to actually learning to love. Right? If you don't know, if you are afraid of the ways that you yourself have experienced what it means to be powerless, vulnerable, abandoned, you will actually, at best, be unhelpful, and at worst, be actively oppressive of someone else. Just think about all the families you know where someone has not processed the things they've been through and basically obliterates people in their family circle as a result. Right? Does anyone not know anyone like that? And so I think it's very important that we read Va'atem yedatem et nefesh hager as actually a kind of mitzvah. Right? You actually have to know the parts of you that have the capacity to generate love, but also the capacity to manifest as hostility, cruelty, rage. It reminds me of this notion, right, that Chazal don't say, Hillel does not say, do unto others as they've done unto you, right, but rather, do unto others as you wish they would do unto you. Right? The law is not, oh, right, other people degraded and humiliated me, therefore I can't wait till I have some power in this world. Right? That's very much not what Hillel is talking about. That which is hateful to you. And what I'm suggesting is we understand that the only way, in a sense, to ensure, to come close to ensuring not repeating the things that have been done to us, is to be fully aware of the experience of what's been done to us. Right? Otherwise, there's no freedom from those things. They're just alive in us. Okay. Questions, responses, thoughts, reflections.
What about someone who hasn't, who feels like they really haven't had that estrangement or suffering? I mean, or like a child.
So then I would say two things. One is that obviously very important to the Torah is the collective story of our people suffering, and maybe that's part of it, that there's always a story of suffering to tap into, right? Because the primary meaning here is as Jews, as a collective, you have known suffering. But also, you know, Abby, I'm tempted to say this, and I'm not sure I would defend this, but it is at least what comes to my mind. I wonder whether someone who says, I've never had an experience of estrangement, is actually not being open to the range of their experience by definition. Because it's one thing if I say, okay, estrangement means that my parent verbally, you know, decimated and destroyed me day after day. Some people haven't had that. But what about the feeling of estrangement as in, you know, being a little kid and feeling that nobody likes you? Is there any kid who hasn't had some version of that moment? Right? Or, you know, an adult who walks into a new social setting, right? And, like, is struggling with all kinds of ways of protecting from their own vulnerability, right? You walk into a room and you decide within 1 second you hate everyone there. Right? What are you doing? What are you doing when you do that, right? I mean, you're covering your own fear of being estranged and powerless in that situation. So I'm not sure I believe anyone who says that. Like, I'm not sure this means everyone has to have been, you know, horrifically abused. Thank God that's not true. But some version from which I can grow in love, hard for me to believe that anyone has not had that. Okay. Vicky, has something you want to say? No? Okay. You look like you're... Okay.
Okay.
should not ever be considered more interesting. So, unless the answer is simply that a more specific reason needs to be given, or a more specific motivation needs to be given, of why we should be so kind, because of the topic or whatever, I guess that's the question of why we what you said. You are commanded to be kind to everyone, no matter how great you feel, no matter how much you feel, no matter how much you feel, no matter how much you feel.
Because I think, see, this is sort of where I get this idea from, which is, I think that the Torah is not interested in just doing kindness to others. It's interested in also loving others. And it thinks you can't do that without having, A, appreciation for the kindnesses that have been done with you, for you, and B, awareness of the unkindnesses that have been done to you. Meaning, to just say you're commanded to be kind to other people, great. What's the inner work? So I'm suggesting that implicitly the Torah is saying, in a way, no matter what your situation is. Right? I mean, but it's actually asking you to derive the strength to love from the depth of your own experiences. So let me put it this way, okay? The Torah does both things. On the one hand, if I open up the Shulchan Aruch and I read the list of things I have to do, Bikur Cholim is among that list. Visit the sick, right? But the Torah is also interested in pushing me to deepen my capacity to be present to others, right? So there's a baseline, right? And the baseline is, oh yeah, you have an obligation. Be kind, period. But the Torah is also interested in what kind of human being I am. And it's not interested in a human being who just does kindness because, oh, I don't wear shotness and I do kindness. Meaning it's all about, right? Right? So the point is, so it also wants to appeal to the depths of experiences you've had as a human being. Right? The gift of life and the pain of estrangement. Right? But kindness doesn't depend, you said that very well, right? That's sort of the point. It doesn't depend on, right, you know, oh, I've now finished 97 years in therapy and I'm ready to start being kind, right? No, that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about you have an obligation to be kind, period. And, but, you should also be working on yourself to deepen your capacity to be kind. Well, let me put it in a different way. I would suggest, I mean, maybe there are exceptions to this, okay? But someone who is aware of the ways that they have suffered is likely to be able, this goes to Abby's comment before, to be present to someone who is sick much more deeply than someone who is not aware of that. Because someone who is not aware of that is going to, consciously or not, usually not, going to be trying to fend off the feelings that frighten them. Therefore, if the situation emits too much vulnerability, they have to shut it down. Oh, it'll be fine. You'll be fine. I'm sure you'll be fine. What the hell do you know? And that's sort of the point I'm trying to get to, is what enables it to be deepened is these appeals to the range of our experiences.
I agree entirely with you. I think it's the methodology of how we might be able to sort of morally or intrinsically derive that these concepts are true sort of in ourselves. But look how much gymnastics it's taken for us to read it into the text of the Torah. I guess that's
by the way, it's interesting. I don't see this as particularly gymnastically skillful. I think this is actually kind of pretty straightforwardly what the Torah is up to. I mean, it's certainly around the case of loving the stranger. There's not a lot of steps. Well, you know what I would say here? I would say the Torah operates on, and here I'm not talking about the Torah, I'm not, Torah operates on many levels. For many people, depending on what level of spiritual openness and awareness they're able to cultivate. Right? Meaning, for some people, the stage of their life, you guys really, oh yeah, you know what, you have to visit the sick, period. And then for those who want to read carefully, And read carefully is not just a literary activity, but a kind of existential willingness to like think more deeply. It gets deeper. So, and the Torah needs to be interpreted. Look, you know, the risk of any inherited tradition which contains lots of stuff in it, right, not getting to its truest culmination is very real, right? We are all aware, right, of the ways in which people can become more cruel precisely by dint of being religious, which is the opposite of this. We're all aware of that, which is why it matters a lot what it means to interpret texts rather than just pretend to just be reading them. Right? I mean, there's obviously a lot to say about that. By the way, that's one of the more amazing things that Rav Kook says in the introduction to the third volume of Orot HaKodesh. Rav Kook actually makes this comment, which is just astonishing, where he says, if you become religious and you find that your moral intuitions are deepened and you want to serve others more deeply, that's a pretty good sign that you're becoming religious is real. But if you become religious and you find yourself contemplating suspending what you think of as your basic moral intuitions because you think religion requires that of you, you know prima facie that that's not actually, it's what he calls yira psula. It's just false fear of God. It's something else masquerading as fear of God, right? I mean, it often occurs to me that like if I could like gather every religious leader in the world and like teach one text, it would be that, right? Because it's an amazing text. But of course, what it implies is that religion makes, you know, I'm a little bit hesitant to share this, but because it's so caustic and it's part of this whole, you know, phenomenon of people who are professional religion haters. But this one physicist, Steven Weinberg, who has these incredibly like ferocious things to say about religion, he says, you know, you can train kind people to do kind things. You can train cruel people to do cruel things. But to train kind people to do cruel things, for that you need religion. It's one of the most sort of withering kind of like, you know, it's the kind of line that like Richard Dawkins reads and wishes he had written. Now, the point is that, you know, okay, might be true. It's also probably true that to get awful people to have moments of incredible kindness, you probably also need religion. Or you need religion in either case. But the point is that we're all too aware in our world of that, you know, religion is like dynamite. Yeah.
So I made a similar comment about the safer finding a vote conversation, which is that I'm wondering if we shift the focus, and other people's comments have definitely like been along the close to this line, we shift the focus to the naked person who's being clothed. And we try to read these texts as being the vulnerable party on whom this chesed is being bestowed. I wonder if you come to the same conclusion, if you kind of have to rewrite the conclusions that we've come to here, or if you can sort of flip them and say the converse of a lot of the things that you've just been saying, such as, like, if you're aware of how you've suffered, you can better be there for others in their suffering. So to flip that and to say, if you're aware of how you've suffered, you can allow others to better be there for you in your suffering. Or if those kinds of things have to be rewritten once that's...
Yeah, right. I think there's a lot to say about that. I'm not sure that that is the primary concern of these texts, but I think it's an interesting implication that one could draw out.
Do you think there is an obligation when... I mean, there are obligations on... I don't know the halachic... Obligations on gerim, to the extent at which they should maybe allow themselves to be... Care.
Yeah, and staka as well. Yes, I'm just not sure that's what these texts are about. There is that notion of being willing to accept. Yeah, it is there. We could talk about this more. Let me just say two very quick things in closing, which are actually, they're big things. But one is that I included here a text that I think I did with you guys the beginning of this year. If you turn the page to where it says Sifrei Dvarim Parshat Ekev, I just want to remind you of this amazing text that basically says, right, if you want to know God, you should learn Agadah, because through Agadah, you will know God, umidavek bidrachav, right, and cleave to his ways. And as you may recall, I showed this to you because I think it's this amazing, amazing text, right? It's like, I ask you, oh, what would it take for me to know God? And you say, oh, do X, because through X you can know God. And through that, you'll bestow chesed on others. And there's part of you who wants to say, well, I didn't ask you about that. I asked you about wanting to know God. What does that have to, right? And the text here seems to come along and basically say, no, if it's God you know, it can't but manifest as chesed. And I would say it the other way, right? Which is, maybe this is an interesting test about whether what we're learning is Torah or something else. Right? If one walks out of learning without having deepened one's love, one has spent a shiur or a day or a year amassing information, which is not Talmud Torah. That's, I think, the implicit. I mean, that's the negative formulation of it. Of course, what the Midrash is powerful is the positive formulation of it, which is, if you learn and you come to know, you can't but become like, right? Okay. Now, the last thing maybe that I will just sort of say about this is there's a whole section here at the end that I wanted you to see, which is a whole series of texts, both from the Gemara and from the Rambam, that I just think are kind of interesting, which suggest that... Now, there's a triumphalist reading of this that is very problematic, but there's also an interesting reading of this that is, I think, extremely challenging, that suggests that the sort of defining characteristic of being Jewish is compassion. What the Gemara calls Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim, that's the definition of Israel, right? Compassionate ones, children of compassionate ones. And Rambam goes so far as to paskin, right? That someone who is always fighting with others and not kind to others, at a certain point it becomes important that we investigate whether they're really Jewish. Now, you could see that as problematic in that he basically says, yeah, because the Gentiles are like that. Okay, fine. But the point is that I think he's also saying something that's enormously sort of powerful, which is like, you know, you could talk as much as you want about, oh, I do this mitzvah, I do that mitzvah. But in some fundamental way, who you are as a person is constitutive, defining of what it means to be a Jew. I mean, right? That's kind of basically his argument. What it means to be part of this people, right, is to be a compassionate one. Now, I want to just say in closing, I had a conversation last week in Israel with someone which has really kind of been on my mind pretty much nonstop, and it's a way of ending. It'll sound negative, but I want to say it in a way that the opposite is the case. I had a conversation with someone last week in Israel who said to me basically the following. He said, I spent 25 years teaching in yeshiva, and then I quit one day because I realized it was all bankrupt. Right? Because it was just people learning to read texts better, and I didn't really have the sense that it was, in the places I was teaching, about chesed or loving God or loving other people. It was just, and it was worse than that. He said it was a competition. Who has a better memory? After all, we define the Gadol Hador in contemporary Israeli discourse as the person who remembers the most texts. He said, like, and I just wanted out. Like, I was done, right? That's not learning Torah. That whole thing is not learning Torah. Now, okay. So, I'm sure there are yeshivot, or let me put it differently. I'm sure there are teachers in yeshivot who teach a Torah that's all about chesed. But I want to just sort of... The negative version of that is the positive challenge that I want to reiterate now, as you know, we're now not at the beginning of the year anymore. I put this to you at the very first day, but I want to re-put it to you now, which is, what's the work we have to do to make sure that the Torah we learn is Torah? And what are the tests we apply, right? If, let me put it a different way, the aspiration is that after a year, a month, a week, a day, an hour of learning Torah, I should discover in myself a deeper capacity to love and care for others, and to understand that actually what it means to love God is to know that that's actually the very heart of what God asks of me. And this person, by the way, is very inspiring to me, because instead of walking away, he basically decided, I'm going to found an institution that's about going back to what this person thinks it means to learn, which is learning that's constantly reminding itself of tikkun hamidot, right, of working on oneself as very basic constituent of what it means to be a religious person. So in a way, you know, my bracha / challenge for myself, and I share with all of you, is that learning Torah deepens our capacity to love and be present to the vulnerable, and to turn our experiences, both positive and negative, into kind of the capacity to love more deeply. Yisher koach. And remember, the session with Lynn Kay is now.
Is there...